Welcome to the 39th Malinowski Memorial Lecture. As many of you will know, this lecture was instituted to commemorate Bronislaw Malinowski, the first professor of social anthropology in the London School of Economics and the founding genius of British social anthropology. Unlike many distinguished lectures which are given to very senior people at the end of their career, the Malinowski Memorial Lecture was always designed to be awarded to somebody who was closer to the beginning than the end of their career, somebody who had already achieved a great deal but was expected to achieve much more in the future, for rising stars, as it's often been put. The lecturer is elected by members of the department, and for the first time for many years, we decided to select one of our own, Rita Astuti, who is, I say, going to give you her lecture shortly. Rita was educated in Italy, graduated from the University of Siena in 1984, and she came to the LSE to do her master's in anthropology, and then she went on to do her PhD here, which was awarded to her in 1991. For her fieldwork, she worked among the Vezo of Madagascar between 1987 to 1989. She's been back more than once. And again in 1998, she started a second lengthy project among the Vezo, focusing on, I quote, processes of social categorization and the intuitive understanding of biological inheritance. From her thesis, Rita published a much praised book, People of the Sea, Identity and Descent Among the Vezo of Madagascar, which came out from Cambridge University Press in 1995. But since the second period of fieldwork, and in collaboration with Maurice Bloch and with other scholars from America and France, many of whom we're very pleased to have in the audience this evening, Rita has been working on the interface between anthropology and cognitive psychology, and that is the topic which she's going to discuss with us this evening. The title is, Are We All Natural Dualists? A Cognitive Developmental Approach. Rita Astuti.
My case is not working. In an essay written to commemorate the Malinowski centennial year in 1984, Raymond Firth remarked that cognitive anthropology is essentially an inferential study. Since anthropologists infer informants' ways of thinking from linguistic expressions, anthropological inferences are supported by the common and not entirely implausible assumption that language provides clues to thought. Having noted the complexity of the relations between thought and language, Firth argued that anthropological assertions about cognition should be treated as tentative, not tested summations of mental process. Since anthropologists work with gross, crude analytical tools involving wholesale inference, much speculation, and some introspective analogy, he concluded that their generalizations should be accordingly modest. Anthropologists cannot be said to have heeded this advice, as they routinely infer patterns of thought from patterns of speech and make generalizations that can hardly be described as modest. In this lecture, I will address one of anthropology's favorite assertions about cognition, the ubiquitous claim that non-Western peoples are free from the traps of dualistic thinking, that their way of reasoning and of representing the world is not cast within the Cartesian dichotomy of mind and body. It's been remarked that social science theorizing has a widespread tendency to vilify Cartesian dualism as a kind of moral abjection. There is also confusion about what exactly the domain for dualism is, as discussions freely shift from the domain of mind-body proper to other domains such as conscious, unconscious, thought, emotion, object, subject. In anthropology, of course, the mind-body dichotomy has been cast in terms of a dichotomy between culture and biology and its many derivatives, such as the distinction between sex and gender, person and organism, individual and society. There are therefore as many anthropological claims of monism as there are versions of dualistic reasoning. The specific one I will be addressing tonight has emerged in the field of kinship and gender studies and is arguably one of the most robust and uncompromising versions of the widespread anthropological claim that non-Western peoples are not dualists. The claim, more precisely, is that non-Western peoples do not draw the distinction between the biological facts of procreation and their cultural interpretation, between biological and social parenthood, between the natural body and its cultural meanings, between nature and culture, sex and gender. The battle in support of this form of non-Western monism has been fought on many grounds, theoretical as well as empirical. On the theoretical front, anthropologists appear recently to have found comfort in Bruno Latour's revelation that we, Western peoples, have actually never been modern, and that we have worked as hard at creating hybrids of nature and culture as we have at separating the two. On the empirical front, many have followed in Schneider's footsteps and have argued that non-Western understandings of relatedness and of gender identities are not predicated on the distinction between the biological and the social. It is fair to say that this idea has become one of the most guarded assets of the discipline, giving its practitioners an edge in a number of philosophical and political debates. By way of illustration, let me quote a passage from an influential essay by Tim Ingold. In the context of a general philosophical argument against various dualistic fallacies that besiege the social sciences, and more specifically against the foundational separation between social and biological domains in kinship theory, Ingold notes that, I quote, many, if not most, non-Western peoples simply do not recognize anything comparable to the social-biological distinction as articulated in Western discourse. If given a weak interpretation, this claim is both true and trivial. That the distinction between the social and the biological, like that between nature and culture, or mind and body, is not articulated in other cultural traditions as it is in the Western one, is granted and has been repeatedly proven. But the claim is far stronger and is far from trivial. Namely, that, I quote again, for them, the human being is not a two-part entity, half organism, half person, but a single, undivided, and embodied center of action and awareness, an organism person that neither simply grows of its own accord nor is made like an artifact, but is rather grown through the active contributions of many people, including those who may be designated as parents. The claim is that most, if not all, non-Western peoples do not distinguish between the biological and bodily processes that make an organism grow and the social and mental processes that shape personhood, between the biological processes of reproduction and the social processes of nurture, between biological and social parenthood. Tonight, I shall challenge this idea. I shall do so in the same spirit in which Alfred Gell has argued that ordinary human beings, whether Western or not, are natural dualists, naturally predisposed to split the person into two, the mind inside, the body outside. Like many of the anthropologists who have argued the opposite, Gell was more than aware of the philosophical pitfalls of dualism. However, he reminded us that the task of anthropology is not to prescribe notions that are philosophically defensible, but, I quote, to describe forms of thought which could not stand up to much philosophical scrutiny, but which are nonetheless socially and cognitively practicable. It follows that describing natural dualism as a socially and cognitively practicable form of thought does not amount to endorsing its philosophical validity. Similarly, describing how ordinary human beings distinguish between organism and person, between birth and nurture, between the biological and the social, does not amount to endorsing the philosophical or metaphysical validity of any of these distinctions. The two issues of description and of philosophical validity are separate and should be kept separate. Indeed, as I see it, the real challenge for anthropologists is not to collect examples of sound philosophical thinking among the people they study, but to establish less crude analytical tools to generalize about the way ordinary human beings think. Tonight, I shall endeavor to describe how one group of non-Western peoples, the Vezu of Madagascar, reason about the distinction between birth and nurture, organism and person, mind and body. Vezu ethnography provides plenty of evidence that could be used to support the anthropological claim that non-Western peoples do not draw such distinctions. For example, Vezu find the suggestion that birth parents have exclusive claims over their children morally problematic, and they express this view in a variety of ways. Thus, they seemingly do not see resemblances between parents and their offspring. Instead, they invoke a variety of mechanisms other than birth to explain the way babies come to resemble people other than their biological parents. For example, if a pregnant woman spends a lot of time talking to a friend, the friend is said to steal some of the baby's facial traits. If she takes a strong dislike for someone, her baby will look like the disliked person. The expectation that babies will come to resemble people other than their parents has the effect of socializing parenthood and of extending the child's bodily connections beyond those with its birth parents. On the basis of this kind of evidence, it would be an easy task to show that Vezu do not distinguish between organism and person, birth and nurture, biological and social parenthood. I shall argue, nonetheless, that the kind of evidence that I've just invoked, which is the kind of evidence routinely used by anthropologists, does not support the inference that Vezu have successfully escaped the traps of dualistic reasoning. By means of an empirical investigation which targets informants' inferential reasoning rather than relying on their normative explicit statements, I shall demonstrate that Vezu adults do in fact draw the distinction between the biological processes that determine the organism and the social processes that shape personhood. And although what I offer tonight is but one carefully examined case, the evidence that I present raises broader questions about the foundations of anthropological knowledge. In this lecture, however, I also aim to move the argument forward. I shall do so by extending the investigation to Vezu children in order to pursue new questions about the relationship between implicit and explicit knowledge. The work that I will present is the result of a collaborative project between anthropologists and cognitive psychologists, Maurice Bloch, Susan Carey, Greg Solomon, and myself. Susan Carey and Greg Solomon originally devised the experimental procedure which Maurice Bloch piloted among the Zafi Manir of Madagascar, and which I have used extensively among the Vezu with both children and adults. What I shall describe below as the adoption task was part of Carey and Solomon's investigation of North American children's intuitive understanding of birth and of the role that birth plays in the transmission of properties from parents to offspring. We adopted their task for use in Madagascar to explore the same questions cross-culturally and developmentally. Additional research questions stemming from my previous work on Vezu social classification were also addressed experimentally. Carey and Solomon provided the necessary training in experimental methods and helped adapt the task to Malagasy circumstances. To this, I added my long-standing relationship of mutual trust with Vezu villagers, and they added their goodwill and open-mindedness. as to the practical administration of various versions of the task to over 180 participants, I must acknowledge the help of a very patient and, when it came to children, indispensable research assistant, my son, Sean. Finally, Solomon undertook the statistical analysis of the data, and he's co-author of an article that presents in detail the data on which I base my analysis tonight. First of all, let me briefly describe the adoption task used with North American children. The task was originally devised to establish at what age children develop an adult-like understanding of the transmission of properties from parents to offspring. Solomon and Carey noted that North American children as young as 3 or 4 years of age systematically predict that offspring resemble their parents. For example, that blonde parents will have blonde children. And they set out to probe children's understanding of the mechanisms responsible for the resemblance. In particular, they wanted to establish at what age North American children adopt the view, as adults do, that resemblance to parents involves two separate causal mechanisms for the transmission of two ontologically distinct traits of the person. In other words, at what age do children adopt the view that birth is the mechanism responsible for transmitting characteristics such as bodily traits, and that nurture, learning, and habituation are responsible for transmitting other characteristics such as mental traits. The adoption task was devised, that they devised, pitted biological against social parentage and the transmission of bodily traits against the transmission of mental traits such as beliefs, that is, things that are held to be true. They found that up to the age of 7, North American children are as likely to predict that birth transmits both bodily and mental traits as they are to predict that nurture transmits both traits. These children, therefore, do not differentiate between birth and nurture, bodily and mental traits. In Madagascar, I used an adapted version of the Solomon and Carey task to establish the presence or absence of dualistic reasoning among Vezu adults and children. In its simplest form, the Malagasy adoption task consisted in telling participants a story about a baby born to one set of parents and raised by another one. The birth parents, described in Vezu idiom as the father and mother who generated the child, are traveling through the forest. They are attacked by bandits. They have time to hide the baby under a bush. The parents are killed. The baby survives and is found and raised by another set of parents. The adoptive parents, described as the father and mother who raise the child, nurture him with affection and love. The story was followed by questions which asked participants to decide whether the grown-up child would resemble the birth or the adoptive father on a number of different traits, bodily traits, beliefs, and skills. A control task was devised to establish whether participants might reason differently depending on whether the link of filiation targeted by the questions was paternal or maternal. Since, interestingly, there was no evidence of a systematic effect, in what follows I shall ignore this variable. The questions were formulated as follows. The father who generated the child had, for example, pointed ears, whereas the father who raised the child had roundish ears. In your opinion, when the child is fully grown up, will he have pointed ears like the father who generated him, or roundish ears like the father who raised him? And the father who generated the child believed that chameleons have 30 teeth, whereas the father who raised the child believe that chameleons have 20 teeth. In your opinion, when the child is fully grown up, will he believe that chameleons have 30 teeth, like the father who generated him, Or will he believe that chameleons have 20 teeth, like the father who raised him? Note that the task set out an artificial problem, a riddle, to which participants were asked to find a solution. The aim was to keep the riddle as culture-free, as culture-neutral as possible. For example, the story was devised in such a way that it did not evoke the social and moral setting in which adoption normally takes place among the Vezu. And the traits for the resemblance questions were chosen because they were not culturally salient. For example, nobody knew or cared to know how many teeth chameleons have, if any. Overall, the task was designed to force participants, as it were, to put their thinking cap on and leave their cultural narratives to one side. Thus, the task did not require participants to articulate verbally their customary ways of explaining things, nor to provide an abstract account of how properties are transmitted from one generation to the next. In the case of children, this was a clear advantage, since they are notoriously unable to put their knowledge into words. In the case of adults, the advantage was that the riddles did not directly prime their stock cultural knowledge, but require them to engage in inferential reasoning. It could be argued that the adoption task imposes on the participants the ontological categories of the researcher, the dualism of sociality and biology, of organism and person, of mind and body. But although the task is undoubtedly constructed around these distinctions, it does not force them on the participants. If participants do not distinguish between social and biological parenthood, between birth and nurture, between bodily and mental traits, they will sail through the task blissfully unaware of the distinctions being probed. Imagine by analogy a task devised to establish whether participants perceive the difference between red and green. You would probably agree that taking part in such a task will not force colorblind participants to see the difference. The adoption task has four possible outcomes, defined in terms of each participant's pattern of judgment. Participants are said to show a differentiated pattern if they judge that the adopted child would resemble the birth father on bodily traits and the adoptive father on beliefs. Their response implies a distinction between two chains of causal mechanisms, birth and nurture, which transmit two distinct traits of the person, bodily traits and beliefs. Participants are said to show a birth-parent bias if they judge that the adopted child would resemble his birth parent on all or almost all traits, that is, both bodily traits and beliefs. They're said to have shown an adoptive parent bias if they judge that the adopted child would resemble his adoptive parent on all or almost all traits. Participants who show either a birth parent or an adoptive parent bias draw no theoretically driven distinction between birth and nurture as separate mechanisms for the transmission of bodily and mental traits. Finally, participants who judge the adopted child to resemble birth and adoptive parents in a random combination of traits are classified as showing a mixed pattern. They are most evidently clueless about the distinctions probed by the task. Their pattern of judgment reveals that they do not reason causally about the mechanisms of birth and nurture, neither, of course, that they distinguish between the two. Okay, now that you know the rules of the game, let me introduce the results of the adoption task used with male and female Vezu adults aged 21 and above. Although most of them were initially bemused by my questions, midway through the task, they would suddenly realize that only half of my questions were about the boy's body, Vatani, while the other half, the ones that were going to come, were about his mind, Saini. And their faces at this point would light up in recognition. This moment of recognition gave rise to the following results. An overwhelming 78% of adult participants showed a differentiated pattern, shown in blue. Of the remaining 22%, 13% showed a mixed pattern, shown in light green, 6% a birth parent bias, shown in red, and 3% an adoptive parent bias, shown in yellow. The overwhelming majority of VESU adults, therefore, drew the distinction between birth and nurture. They reasoned that birth is the mechanism responsible for the transmission of bodily traits, whereas nurture is the mechanism responsible for the transmission of mental traits, such as beliefs. Their inferences, for example, that the adopted boy will resemble his birth father in the shape of his ears, but will resemble his adoptive father in the belief about chameleon's teeth, their inferences were guided by a theory about the different character of mind and body and the distinctive causal mechanisms affecting them. By contrast, VESU adults did not invoke the monism that informs their explicit cultural statements, such as the explanations used to account for babies' physiognomy. Had they done so, they would have reasoned that nurturing relations mold every trait of the person, mental as well as bodily. The first conclusion to be drawn from these findings, which converge with those of Maurice Bloch's investigation among the Zeffi Manieri, is that there is a significant discrepancy between what VESU adults say, the enunciations that get transmitted and are part of what anthropologists would identify as VESU culture, a discrepancy between what VESU adults say and the theoretical presuppositions that people mobilize to reason inferentially, irrespective of their cultural narratives. In other words, there is a discrepancy between explicit linguistic statements and implicit theoretical knowledge. This finding gives support to the argument that informants' ontological commitments cannot be inferred from their explicit discourse. It follows that anthropologists cannot advance claims about the absence of dualistic reasoning in non-Western societies based on the interpretation of explicit enunciations, as it is most commonly done. The result has far-reaching methodological implications and casts skepticism over some of the most attention-demanding claims made by anthropologists about personhood, gender, kinship, the moral economy, the body, subjectivity, and so on. My aim, however, is to put forward a rather more challenging proposition for anthropologists, namely that we cannot understand what our informants explicitly tell us, let me loosely call it culture, if we ignore the theoretical cognitive underlay of their statements. There is an obvious logical reason for this. If it is true that what people say and enshrine in their explicit cultural statements can diverge from the implicit theories that they mobilize to reason inferentially, it follows that one cannot correctly understand their statements without knowing how these articulate with their implicit theories. For example, statements that appear to blur the distinction between birth and nurture, body and mind, let's call them monistic statements, will have to be interpreted differently and understood differently if they are uttered in the context of a monistic ontology, context one, in which case they would reflect people's ontological commitments, or if they are uttered in the context of a dualistic ontology, context two, in which case they contradict people's ontological commitments. Needless to say, the meaning of an utterance will be seriously misjudged if contradictions are interpreted as reflections. The logical reason why anthropologists need to take into account the implicit cognitive underpinning of their informants' statements has been noted before. There is, however, a separate developmental reason which has remained unexplored and to which I now turn. The hypothesis that I shall pursue in the second half of this lecture is that the production and transmission of the conceptual systems that anthropologists deduce from their informants' explicit cultural enunciations and describe in their monographs about personhood, relatedness, identity, presuppose the emergence of the theoretical differentiation between birth and nurture, mind and body, found among Vesu adults. I shall explore this hypothesis by means of a research strategy pioneered by Christina Torin, which consists in turning one's attention to children to ask how they come to make sense of the way adults conceptualize the world in which they live. The specific question I shall ask is this: do Vesu children distinguish, like Vesu adults, between birth and nurture, body and mind? The answer, in short, is that they don't. And this discovery makes possible to compare within the same population a group that does not have a dualistic ontology, the children, and one that does, the adults. The comparison allows me to pursue a more general question about the relationship between adults' implicit ontological distinctions and the explicit cultural statements that get transmitted to their children. As we will see, in the absence of a dualistic ontology, children not only fail to understand and are able to coherently reproduce such statements, but they also fail to understand why and how they've come to be what they are. Let me begin by examining the results of the adoption task carried out with these children of both sexes, age 6 to 13. As you can see from the graph, children on the left, is that right? Yes. Performed very differently from adults. And overall, 80% did not show a differentiated pattern of judgments. Of these, 40% showed a mixed pattern, shown in light green, 30% a birth parent bias, shown in red, 18% an adoptive parent bias, shown in yellow. The differentiated pattern in blue, which was 78% among adults, was instead a mere 12% among the children. Let me remind you again what these results mean. Children were as likely to judge that either birth or nurture, or both, affect the way people appear in their body as well as in their mental traits. Unlike adults, children's inferences were not guided by the theoretically driven differentiation between birth and nurture. Therefore, each answer was settled on the basis of a variety of ad hoc reasons, simple guess, preference for one set of parents over the other, preference for individual traits, and so on. In short, Vesu children did not see the distinctions drawn by the task. They thereby fulfill the anthropological dream of a population with a known dualistic ontology. As you recall, the hypothesis I raised is that the capacity of Vesu adults to differentiate between birth and nurture, body and mind, is a prerequisite for the production and transmission of their cultural knowledge. To test this hypothesis, I now turn to a particularly salient cultural trait, the set of ideas that specify what it means to be Vesu and how some people come to be us while others come to be them. I do this to explore whether children who do not differentiate like adults are able to understand and reproduce what their parents teach them about their social surroundings. The criteria Vesu adults use for classifying people are explicit and can be summarized as follows. People are what they are because of the place where they live, which in turn determines the activities they perform. Group affiliation, as well as the difference between us and them, are established through the actions that different people perform in their physical and social environment. This way of classifying the social world is typically articulated by adults in a variety of informal contexts which portray the contrast between Vesu people and their immediate neighbors, the Masikuru. Adults constantly and consistently invoke the principle that Being Vezu is to live on the coast and do Vezu things, such as fishing, sailing, and eating fish. Whereas being Masikuro is to live inland and do Masikuro things, such as cultivating, raising cattle, and, so Vezu say, eating grass. This definition of what it means to be Vezu or Masikuro, and the fact that people who are Vezu can become Masikuro and vice versa, implies that the process of social categorization, of social classification, is not mediated by birth. Birth is not the mechanism that transmits group affiliation between generations. One does not need to be born Vezu or Masikuro to be one. All one needs is to learn to do Vezu or Masikuro things. Vezu's social classification is thus based on activity criteria. Namely, Vezu use the performance of certain activities as the criterion for classifying people. However, before extending this conclusion to the classification of all social groups, I must preempt a potential source of confusion. It could be that Vezu use activity criteria to distinguish Vezu and Masikuro people only because they regard both groups as subunits of the same superordinate ancestral group. In other words, they might be invoking occupation as a criterion for identification, and they might be disregarding people's ancestral origins because they assume that Vezu and Masikuro people shared the same origins to begin with. Thus, to establish that Vezu use activity criteria to classify all social groups, one must be able to show that Vezu informants extend that way of reasoning to people of unquestionably separate ancestral origins. The counterpart I chose for testing the hypothesis were the Karani. Karani are immigrants of Indo-Pakistani descent. They are town dwellers, they are wealthy and well-educated, they are shopkeepers and money lenders. They are predominantly Muslim, and although fluent in Malagasy, they speak their own language among themselves. Somatically, they differ from the Vezu in that their skin is light and their hair straight. In Western folk sociology, Vezu and Karani would be regarded as separate racial groups. The preliminary issue that needed to be established was therefore this. Do Vezu adults reason about Karani in the way they reason about Masikuro? Do they classify Karani in terms of what they do rather than in terms of their ancestral origins? In sum, do the activity criteria for social classification extend to all social groups? To explore this question, I used a new version of the adoption task in which the adoption occurs across the Vezu-Karani divide. A boy is born to one set of parents, either Vezu or Karani, and is adopted by parents of the opposite group. Participants were asked the standard set of resemblance questions about bodily traits, beliefs, and skills, but were also asked about a number of contrastive traits that are considered typical of Vezu and Karani people, such as their occupation or religious beliefs. For example, will the adopted boy know how to fish, Vezu typical, or to keep shop, Karani typical? Will he believe that corpses must be kept overnight in the village, Vezu typical, or will he believe that one has to bury them straight away, Karani typical? And finally, I asked the crucial question about the child's identification. Would he be Vezu or Karani? As a control, I also ran an identical task in which adoption occurred across the Vezu-Masikuro divide. And here are the results from the two versions of the task. As you see on the left of the graph, the performance on the Vezu-Masikuro version was unsurprising. As expected, 87% of adult participants judged that the adopted child, irrespective of birth origins, would grow up to be Vezu if raised by Vezu parents in a Vezu village, and Masikuro if raised by Masikuro parents in a Masikuro village. The child was judged to have acquired all the traits typical of his adoptive group. Similarly, if more strikingly, 75% of other participants in the Vesukarani task that you have on the right also judged that the adopted child, irrespective of birth origins, would grow up to be Karani if raised by Karani, and Vesu if raised by Vesu. As before, on virtually all traits, the child was judged to resemble his adoptive father. This, you will agree, is a remarkable result. The fact that adults reasoned about Karani in the same way in which they reasoned about Masikuru vindicates the general claim that Vesu make use of activity criteria to classify all groups of people. More importantly, it shows that Vesu adults reason about social categories coherently, drawing on a consistent integrated theory of social classification. The crossover along the Vesu-Karani divide is not an occurrence that my informants have ever experienced in real life, nor do they ever contemplate it in their conversations. Thus, unlike participants in the Vesu-Masikuru task, whose replies came spontaneously and without effort, participants in the Vesu-Karani task had to respond to an entirely novel situation. They did so by asking themselves, is the adopted boy going to acquire the traits typical of the people he grows up with? Now, the answer to this question was straightforward, because they knew that traits such as occupational skills or religious beliefs are acquired by living in a certain environment. It followed that the boy would be like his adoptive father, because people are classified on the basis of the typical traits that they acquire through practice. In other words, they abstracted a set of theoretical principles from a set of known circumstances and extended such principles to make fruitful predictions about still uncharted social territories. It is precisely this ability to mobilize implicit theoretical knowledge to make novel inferences that children still lack. Children who grow up in a Vesu village are bombarded with messages that people are either Vesu or Masikuru because of what they do. Children hear adults discuss how Vesu ways differ from Masikuru ways. They're frequently told that they are Masikuru when they fail to act in Vesu fashion, and that they're becoming Vesu when they succeed. The idea that being Vesu or Masikuru depends on what people do is thus in the air. It is therefore to be expected that Vesu children will absorb it and be able to reproduce it. To establish this, and more significantly, to establish whether children can apply the abstract theoretical principles underlying this idea to unexpected circumstances, I extended the two adult tasks to the children. And here are the children's results. The most striking finding is that children, unlike adults, performed very differently in the two versions of the task. On the left of the graph, you have the results of the Vesu-Masikuru task. 65% of the children judged that the adopted child will be Vesu-Masikuru like his adoptive father, irrespective of birth origins. The majority of the children thus gave the standard adult response. On the right of the graph, you have the results of the Vesu-Karani task. There, only 27% of the children gave adoptive judgments. By contrast, 73% reasoned that the child will be like his birth father, irrespective of where he grew up. In this case, the overwhelming majority of children reasoned very differently from adults. Let me first turn to the task in which children were asked to reason about the Vesu-Masikuru crossover, where 65% of them gave adoptive judgments. One might conclude from this that the majority of Vesu children have an adult-like understanding of social classification. However, two aspects of their performance indicate that this is not so. Both relate to forms of logical inconsistency. In the first place, children who judged that the boy will be Vesu or Masikuru, like his adoptive father, did not extend this judgment consistently to typical traits, such as occupational skills and religious beliefs. Having stated that the boy would be Masikuru like his adoptive father, for example, the same children stated that the boy would know how to sail and fish like his birth father. They thus fail to comprehend the chain of causal mechanisms, namely place of residence and activities, that underlies the adult's theory of social classification. Secondly, children applied the standard adult explanations that people are Vesu or Masikuru because they fish or cultivate to justify both adoptive and birth judgments. Thus, for example, children explained that the boy would be Vesu like his birth father because he can fish and sail, despite the fact that this boy was raised in the interior, surrounded by cattle and cornfields. In sum, these inconsistencies suggest that children, irrespective of their judgments, were simply mimicking statements that they did not yet fully comprehend. Even children who appeared to give the right sort of answer, that is, the same answer given by adults, display no understanding of the theoretical underpinnings implied to reproduce these statements when primed by familiar questions. But children's grasp of the adult theory stops here, well short of the consistency that characterizes the way adults categorize the social world. Children's inconsistency is also the key to understanding their response to the Vesu-Karani task. As you recall, and you can see on the graph, in this task, an overwhelming 73% of children judged that the adopted boy will be Vesu or Karani like his birth father. Thus, unlike adults, children did not extend to the Karani the same activity criteria for social classification normally applied to Vesu and Masikuru people. This confirms that such principles are still beyond their grasp. Children did not mobilize and extend their knowledge of how people come to be Vesu or Masikuru because their knowledge is still atheoretical and dependent on specific statements they've heard in specific contexts. Children were unable to resort to theoretical principles and to reason analogically about Karani because as yet they do not have, underpinning what they say, a causally integrated theory of social classification. Let me sum up the arguments so far. First, I use the adoption task with Vesu adults and children to establish the presence or absence of dualistic reasoning. The results showed that adults differentiate between birth and nurture, biological and social parenthood, body and mind. Children do not. Second, I examined a salient cultural trait, namely the way adults and children classify people, and thereby established the criteria that make us different from them. The comparison between adults and children's performance in two tasks, one that targeted familiar social distinctions, and the other that targeted entirely novel ones, reveal that Vesu adults rely on a coherent and integrated theory. By contrast, children do not. And so, what makes adults' classification consistent and children's inconsistent? Or to ask the same question from a developmental rather than a static perspective, how is the adults' coherent, integrated theory of social classification constituted and acquired by children? The standard anthropological answer to questions such as how do children become competent adults, how do they acquire their culture, is that this occurs as children gradually learn to see things the adult way as a result of growing up in their cultural environment. For example, as they grow up, Vesu children are exposed to a culturally specific way of classifying people, and they gradually assimilate it and learn to reproduce it. There's clearly some truth in this. Were Vesu children to grow up in a different cultural environment, they would undoubtedly come to classify people very differently. For example, by assuming that social identity is fixed at birth, as people inherit from their forebears the essence that makes them what they are. The comparative perspective I've adopted tonight, however, enables me to ask rather different questions and to suggest different answers. The questions are, what is it that adults have and children don't that allows the adult way of seeing to emerge? Or to put it the other way around, what do children not have that would allow them to compose the fragments of knowledge that are in the air into an integrated set of consistent propositions? The results of the Vezo Masicuro task have shown that there is quite a lot that Vezo children learn directly from adult statements and learn relatively early. When they're teased because they are Masicuro or praised because they are becoming Vezo, they learn that being Vezo and Masicuro has something to do with what they do. Anecdotal evidence suggests that children who are actively engaged in Vezo activities, such as fishing or trading fish, are in fact more likely to answer the question, why are you Vezo, in typical adult fashion, by showing the scars that the fishing line has left on their hands, or by boasting about the profits they've made at the market, rather than by saying, as less experienced children do, that they are Vezo because their parents are. There is, however, a limit to how much children can learn in this direct way. The limit set by what they do not know stops them from composing into a theory the fragments of knowledge that they absorb from Vezo adults. The coherence and predictive potential of Vezo adults' theory rest on a chain of causal mechanisms linking place of residence and activity to social classification. At a more abstract and foundational level, what guides and gives coherence to adult social classification is the theoretically driven differentiation between two separate causal mechanisms, birth and nurture, for the transmission of ontologically distinct traits of the person. Adults have a general rule of thumb for classifying people. The rule is, where people live and what they do will tell you what and who they are. However, they extend this simple rule by adding the capacity to differentiate between traits of the person that are fixed at birth and traits that are transmitted through nurture, learning, and habituation. It is this theoretically driven differentiation that allows them to classify people by systematically disregarding the former traits, for example, skin color, and focusing solely on the latter, for example, occupational skills. By contrast, children have, at best, learned some isolated facts, that certain people are Vezo because they live on the coast and fish, and others are Masicuro because they live in the interior and cultivate. Because children's factual knowledge is not yet integrated with the theoretical presuppositions that underpin the way adults classify people, this knowledge, the children's knowledge, is applied randomly and inconsistently. Consequently, it has neither explanatory power nor predictive fertility. Children do not appreciate the difference between birth and nurture as causal mechanisms for the transmission of ontologically distinct traits of the person. Therefore, they are unable to infer from the fact that people are Vezo because they fish the general conclusion that all kinds of people must be classified by means of traits transmitted through nurture. This inference is beyond children's conceptual understanding because it presupposes the dualistic ontological commitments that they as yet do not make. Only once they make such commitments does their knowledge of certain isolated facts about the social world become a coherent and predictive theory of the social world. Tonight, Vezo children have taught us a few general lessons. I've shown that their ability to produce and reproduce coherent cultural knowledge, such as the Vezo system of social classification, depends on implicit theoretical presuppositions such as the differentiation between birth and nurture. This conclusion has important implications for our discipline. Anthropologists routinely deduce their informants' conceptual systems, concepts of the person, of the self, of relatedness, and their ontological commitments, the absence of the social biological distinction, from knowledge that their informants communicate to them and which ostensibly contains everything that anthropologists need to know. In so doing, however, anthropologists are in danger of grasping only fragments, like children, and of missing out on the presuppositions that underpin adult knowledge and that reconstitute those fragments as coherent predictive theories. Independent support for the argument that comprehension of much of what is communicated to children and anthropologists alike relies on implicit theoretical assumptions comes from pragmatics, the study of how speech utterances as simple as "this lecture is coming to an end" are interpreted by the hearer. Just as the comprehension of the simplest linguistic behavior relies critically on non-linguistic presuppositions, cultural communication, which involves fantastically complex utterances, must do the same. Bezu children, therefore, have taught us that Malinowski was right to relentlessly search for a new scientific method that would free the trained researcher from the deceptions of what he called the question and answer method. Malinowski was mainly concerned about the fact that this method elicited informants' normative statements and therefore distorted the understanding of practical social life. He seemed less concerned about its effect on the understanding of cognitive processes, perhaps because he assumed that these were universal and because he knew no existing method that would satisfactorily reveal them. Participant observation, great linguistic proficiency, a systematic method for recording ethnographic data are some of the methodological tools that we have inherited from Malinowski. As I've shown tonight, these tools are essential but not sufficient to describe our informants' forms of thought. If we wish to provide such descriptions accurately, we should be prepared to advance our methodology by cooperating with other disciplines such as cognitive psychology, thereby keeping to the innovative spirit with which Malinowski created our discipline. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Rita Astuti very much for her provocative and theoretically challenging lecture. She's opened up many new avenues for thought in our discipline, and I'm sure will have a great influence when it comes to be published. I'd also like to thank on your behalf all the Vezu children who were so instrumental in this, but also her research assistant Sean, who has clearly took a very prominent role in bringing together the work which Rita has told us about this evening. It's not the tradition of these lectures to subject the lecturer to any questions, and therefore there will not be any. Instead, she gets a bunch of flowers, and you are asked to join us for drinks in the senior common room on the fifth floor. Thank you.